Hi, it's Gourmet and Goats, and this is episode 8. You might hear a bit of a buzz. Apologies about that. I think there's an issue with one of the mic connections, but I will try and get that sorted out for subsequent episodes. So, we're getting into end of October now, so the news items are slackening off a bit. I'll take the opportunity to give you my news, which was on the 13th of October. I finally got round to going and doing the Round of Glencoe, which is a round which initially was done by Bobby Shields and other guys like that way back sort of in the 80s and before. But then it was complicated a bit because some of the Munros got upgraded. So the route as it is currently was first done by Pete Duggan in 2006, I think, in about 10 and a half hours. And then Dan Gay and John Gay took that down to just over 10 hours in 2013. So yeah, I was keen to really take my kind of current form and strength and go at it kind of race effort. So it's about 38 kilometers, 4,400 meters of ascent, and I got it down to 6 hours 35 minutes. So that was a really, really cool day out, pretty windy, but yeah, great visibility. And I mean, it's as we're going to come on to talk about soon, it was just great to be out in Glencoe taking on all that rough terrain. So my next guest for this episode is a teacher. She's moving slowly further and further north. She lives further north in Scotland than me now. She has been rising from strength to strength, really, in not only the Scottish and British fell running, but also in world skyrunning circuits. So today we're going to talk about many things to do with her running, but we'd really like to focus on Glencoe Skyline and a few of her other kind of big achievements. So I'm pleased to welcome Georgia Tindley.
Hello, how are you?
Fine, thanks very much. So again, we're having to do the interview outside. It's pretty chilly. And I was a wee bit late meeting you, so apologies about that. And I hope the cup of tea that I've just provided has made up for that.
More than made up for it. It's a very good cup of tea.
So we're in Fort William. You live in Kingussie at the moment. Okay.
Yeah.
And what brings you over this way?
I've just been on half term for the last couple of weeks. So I spent some of that down in London visiting my family, and then was itching to get back up here, got back up, jumped in the van, and been travelling around, going running, going cycling, and enjoying the Highlands.
Great.
Yeah, it's been great.
The weather this weekend has been...
The weather's been pretty dodgy.
Yeah.
We had some big plans, and then we cancelled them because the weather was just awful. We were going to do the fish fields, and it rained so much. You know, the road was basically a river, so like, we're never going to get across the actual rivers. So we sacked that off and went for a nice run instead. And yeah, we've been cycling and running ever since.
Biking in Torridon, did I see?
Cycling in Torridon, and took the mountain bikes to Nevis Range yesterday as well.
Okay.
It was good.
Yeah.
So, never been there before.
Cool. Yeah, it's a good spot, lots of trails.
Yeah, lots of trails.
So, I was listening, actually, you did a podcast recently with the guys, Seb and Rob, isn't it? The Mountain Running podcast, and that was really good. I enjoyed listening to that.
That was a funny one.
Yeah, so I was thinking, I'm probably not going to make Georgia laugh as much as those guys. So you're not allowed to laugh at all on my one.
Okay, straight face.
No, it was great. But I thought, you know, there's you've been up to so much and there's so much going on that actually we can talk about different stuff. And, you know, there's there's a lot to go at. So I suppose briefly maybe you could tell us sort of how you came to be a runner and living up here and doing so well in all these races.
Well, I came from a pretty unusual background for a runner, I think, in that I grew up in London and came from a very inactive family and wasn't really that sporty at school.
Okay.
And then, I've always quite liked running, but just did it, you know, a cross-country race once or twice a year for the school. And then came up to Edinburgh for uni and joined the running club.
Okay.
And kind of haven't really looked back. Got into cross-country, did some road running, and just really, really liked it. Fell in love with the process of training, and the group of people as well really made a difference.
It seems like there's a really good gang in Edinburgh, particularly in the unis. There's a lot of people to go running with and a lot of fast runners who, you know, train a lot. And
yeah, it's a really good group in the uni, and then obviously you've got Carnethy and HBT in the city as well, so I think that's good because always older runners around to sort of give lifts to poor students when they need to get through hill races in the middle of nowhere,
and
it's handy like that.
Are you in, which club are you in?
HBT.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Do you always shout at the start of a race?
Just shout random acronyms all the time. No one knows what they mean.
Yeah, and you teach English.
Yes.
And I know a lot of this actually because you were telling me when we went for a run on Carmarthenshire and the Ben.
Mm-hmm.
What about, was that a month ago or so?
Yeah, something like that. A few weeks ago. It was still warm.
Yeah.
Oh, no, it was the first cold run of the year because we both had really runny noses.
Oh, yeah. But yeah, it was, the clocks have just gone back now, so it was like considerably lighter till later.
Yeah.
Then so I know that you are a supply teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you work that with your running at the moment?
So that works out pretty well. My first year living up here, I did full-time teaching. And then for various reasons, the next year came around and I didn't have a job lined up. So I just went into supply. And it's been great actually, because it can be really flexible. I can work a lot in the winter. And then, well, the plan this summer was to stop working and go around Europe in the van and do lots of races, but that'll be postponed for whenever it's possible.
For the foreseeable, And the going around Europe doing races, would that be Sky races mostly?
Sky races, yeah. So I was meant to be doing the World Series this year.
Okay.
Races in Italy and Andorra, I think I'd sign up for in France. And then, that was the plan.
Would it be fair to say that sort of it was really last year that you broke into the European sky racing?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
I think before last year, I'd only ever done the Skyline Scotland races.
Okay.
And I'd done Tromso 2 summers ago, but that was it. And then last year, I was like, decided to put myself out there a bit more and go and try, have a go at some of the other ones and see how it goes. And it went pretty well. It went all right.
Yeah, it went brilliantly. I've just had a wee look actually. So last year you did the Zakop Sky Race, which is that Italy?
Italy, yeah.
I think this one is part of an old race called Sentiero del Grigne or Grigno or something like that.
Oh, I don't know.
Which was a really technical race with loads of kind of pulling on chains and things, which kind of was the reason that I wanted to go and do sky racing initially, because it just looked so kind of different from what we do here. And I think Zakop is kind of based around that old race.
That was a really nice race. It was quite a smooth trail at the start, but then once you got up, there was pulling up chains and scrambling and just incredibly steep terrain, really rocky, and it was really grey and cloudy down in the valley, and then maybe the last 200 metres on the top of the mountain you had this amazing cloud inversion. You could look all around and the sun was out, and there's always lots of Italians out supporting, so it's a great atmosphere on top.
Yeah, Italian sort of race atmosphere is pretty intense, isn't it?
Very intense.
So yeah, a load of cowbells, a load of
People
shouting.
Lining the path, shouting, handing you water, and running alongside you.
Was that and obviously you'd done Sky Races before that in the UK and, like I said, Norway.
Mm-hmm.
Was that the first one where you'd sort of experienced that Euro like spectators and the noise and the kind of buzz of it all?
I'd done some of the mountain running World Cup races before that.
Okay.
So there's one in, I did Smanagora. But they're all much shorter and much less technical, so they're in like 10k or something, and quite easy running. But the same atmosphere, the same intense screaming and bell ringing, which is great.
Yeah. How did you find that helps in a race?
I love it. I think, I don't know, I really like it. I always find that if someone gives me a little cheer when I'm racing, it like massively perks me up. And then I start overthinking it, and I'm like, why has that cheered me up so much? It's so random. But it makes a huge difference, I think, having someone out on the course, whether you know them or not.
It's like, some of my memories from these European Sky Races is like this, like almost like euphoria, because there's like such this crowd atmosphere, mm-hmm. that it just does push you on, gets the best out of you, just gets you so fired up.
And it's quite unifying, I think, knowing that everyone's there for the same reason on this mountain, sometimes in the middle of nowhere, and they've all come for the same purpose, and you're all sort of not having the same experience, but you're all having similar experiences and passionate about the same things. And
yeah. do you think there's, I'm just wondering, do you think there's ever like a downside to having that crowd, like that keys you up and psychs you on, pushes you on so much?
Well, it can definitely start off too quickly. If the crowd's really good at the start of a race, you can get carried away. I think we've all done that at some point.
So you were, so that Zach up when you got some incredible results. You were fifth in that. Hamparokken, which is the Tromso skyline, isn't it? Mm-hmm. You were eighth last year.
Mm-hmm.
You've done that a couple of times now?
Yeah, so I was sixth the year before and eighth last year.
Okay. And how did your time compare those 2 years?
I think it was about an hour faster the time I came eighth. Maybe a bit more. It was a really competitive year, so. But yeah, I'd rather come eighth in a competitive field.
Yes.
I think that's more rewarding, to have run a better time and to feel like I got more out of myself that year.
Skyrunning, it seems it's just getting so more and more popular. It is just getting so competitive at the top end that, I've had similar experiences where you sort of, you run a way better time that you're way more pleased with, but your place is less good in numbers.
Off.
Yeah. But like you say, if you know yourself that
you
ran
race.
Better, then that's
and
progress.
It's exciting that you can see the sport grow year on year. It's just exciting to be a part of.
Yeah. I'm glancing at my list as well. Coma Pedrosa, which is the one down in Andorra, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Sixth in that as well. I mean, these, all incredible results. Snowdon, was that last year? Back on home soil.
Back on home soil, yeah. That was the trials for the GB team to go to the World Champs.
Okay.
Which I didn't make it onto. But, that was a tough race. That was a very tough race.
Right, does it suit your strengths?
No, it was fast and it was flat. And I think I was in about 7th or 8th. And then in the last little bit, you get to go up and down Snowdon, and I pulled it back up to 3rd on the ascent and the descent. But it wasn't enough.
The sort of straight up and down Snowdon race?
No, I think it was about 42, 45k. And you sort of do a big loop through valleys, and it's quite flat. And then you finish going up the back of Snowdon and down the tourist track.
Okay. Yeah, okay. Have you done the straight up and down Snowdon?
I have. I've done it once, and then I did it again, but I sprained my ankle really badly on the way down and had to drop out. Because it's a pretty intense descent coming down there.
Really runnable.
Very runnable. Some big rocks, I found out.
Yeah.
Can turn an ankle.
Well, and just the whole thing is the pace is so fast, isn't it?
And there's that really horrible corner on the road at the end where it gets really steep and your legs are screaming. You've got to sprint on the road to get in.
That's my worst ever race, I think.
Really?
I've only done it once.
Not have a good race.
I just didn't have the speed and it was really hot, which I'm not good in. And yeah, I remember like battling on that final steep road descent for like 10th place and just being like, oh.
That gets good crowds as well though.
Yeah, true.
Especially for a UK race, it's a lot of big turnout.
Right, let me hold you on a second there, because this static stuff is going a bit crazy. I'm just going to pause it. Right, actually, I haven't managed to sort that out. But for next episode, I might have better audio. We'll see. You can hear us both anyway, so that's the main thing. Right, where were we? Yeah, so we're talking about your amazing rise to fame in the Skyrunning series. And, well, I mean, that's not really the best way to say it. I mean, just the rise to just really enjoying it and going out and saying, I'm going to go and do loads of these races and...
go explore, have fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, you've already said you plan to do more of that this year, but obviously not possible with the international situation. What have you been doing this year? What are kind of some of the highlights? In Scotland, let's say. Let's limit you to what are some of the highlights in Scotland this year?
So I bought a camper van near the end of lockdown and just been really enjoying travelling around Scotland, getting to see all the bits that, you know, everyone has these things for years and years. They go, oh, I want to go there, I want to go there, and you never seem to find time. So it's been nice not racing in a way that we can get out, we can explore the places that we've been meaning to go to and never find the time to. So I've just been enjoying, yeah, seeing friends, seeing family, going for runs, and enjoying being in the UK and what that has to offer.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel exactly the same. We're really lucky that in this, you know, in this difficult time to still actually be able to go, and we have loads of hills on our doorstep. And
yeah,
like you said, it's giving us the kind of the time to just go and do those things that you never quite got around to before.
And I think it's easy to forget how good we have it in Scotland when, you know, people are going on about sky running out in Europe and you get these amazing shots of alpine mountains and you're like, wow, that's amazing, I want to jump on a plane and go there. But actually, now that we're all being forced to stay here, there's so much to explore here and it's so good.
And you've been enjoying Le Cabre quite a bit. I was really pleased to see that, because as I've been banging on to people about call them FKTs, call them rounds or records, we'll not go into the semantics of it, but yeah, just people going on these, a lot of them are sort of classic or traditional or obvious mountain challenges.
Mm-hmm.
So you went and did a record on the Le Cabre Traverse.
Yeah.
And you did a record on the kind of classic Ring of Steel.
Yeah.
Route without actually knowing that that I kind of set that as a route.
Yeah, I might have to go back and do that one again, I think.
But I think that's such an obvious one to have as a round. So we're going to come on to talk about the Salomon races, but this one, for those who don't know, is more the classic walkers round, which starts and finishes in Glen Nevis. So it's quite a bit shorter, but in four Munros, and it's just a great wee slice of the Mamors.
Yeah. A really nice route, and you don't have to do that horrible climb out of Kinloch even.
Yeah. And you were you sort of, was that a rest day, or were you running, or were you sort of stopping for?
I was running with a friend who's kind of just starting to get into mountain running.
Okay.
So I was trying to ease him in also, but I thought that was a good route to get going with, because it's not too long. It's not too technical, but you get like great views, you get some excitement.
Yeah.
We stopped and had some sandwiches.
So if you do get another go on it next year or whenever, I'm sure you could take a ton off that.
Yeah, hopefully. I'll have to do it.
And moving further than Scotland. I did mention, I think I mentioned it last episode, your Abraham's Tea Round.
Mm-hmm.
So, tell me about that.
That was just like a really, really good day out. I hadn't really planned on doing it. Just a lot of things suddenly sort of fell into place or went wrong or something. And then I found myself in Keswick, having had like 2 days off because I'd been faffing around, and with a good weather window. And I was like, oh, well, I'll go for it. And yeah, it was a really good day out. It's just one of those days where you feel really good and just really enjoying being out and moving through the mountains, and everything just kind of clicks into place.
And this, I'm kind of really intrigued by this round. So it's down in the Lake District, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And it's does it start and finish at the one of the shops?
Yeah, George Fisher.
George Fisher Outdoor Shop.
Yeah.
Is it every peak you can see from the top floor of the shop or something?
Yeah, I think they've got a cafe at the top and it's every peak you can see from there. But
okay.
And then you finish it, you get a cup of tea.
Ah.
But the cafe's shut at the moment, so.
Did you not get a cuppa?
I didn't get a cuppa.
Oh.
I know, gutted.
You know, if I'd known that, I might not have bothered.
Yeah, it's a long way to go to not get a cup of tea.
So it's, I've got the map in front of us, it's, I don't know those hills that well, but I know some of them. Is it about 45k or something?
Yeah, it's a bit over 45k, and I think it was like 3,500 meters, is that right? Yeah.
Okay.
I think so.
Brilliant. And so you're running, so at Keswick itself, you're a wee way from the hills, aren't you?
Yeah, it's quite a long run in along to roads and flat gravelly tracks before you start climbing, and then at the end as well, when you finish the final descent, there's quite a long stretch along the road on the flats, and at that point I was trying to see if I could go a little bit faster and go sub 6, and then I completely blew up and staggered.
Oh no.
Through Keswick and collapsed outside the shop.
So you went just over 6, did you?
Yeah, I think it was 6:07.
That sounds fast. The previous record was it about 6.5?
I think it was 6:26.
Okay.
Yeah.
And Brennan Townsend's got the male record last year. He's done it quite a few times, hasn't he? I think his record is 5:30 on like his third.
On his third attempt.
Third run of it, yeah. So yeah. I mean, yeah, it looks really cool. Did you know that terrain?
Not really. I hadn't recced it. I'd run a bit in some of the hills on the second half a few weeks before that. I'd done Grisdale Pike and I'd done the climb out of Buttermere, but just kind of coincidentally, I'd gone down there on a really nice day and was like, oh, maybe I should recce the tea round, and then just got carried away with wanting to run in the hills and not stress about. Sometimes it's nice to go for a run and not be wrecking and not be racing and just to go for a run.
Yeah.
So I'd done that. So I knew a bit of them, but I hadn't done the whole thing, and I didn't know any of the stuff the other side of Buttermere, where it gets a bit rougher. Well, I think it mainly got rougher because I couldn't find the path I was meant to be on.
No, it is rough. I've done a wee bit on the Ennerdale race some of those peaks. That is rougher in there, isn't it?
Yeah.
And is this part by Robinson? Sorry for any English runners who are listening, and I don't know the lakes that well yet. Is that similar to the Bob Graham route?
I wouldn't know. I've not looked into the Bob Graham route.
You didn't see George on, because I think it was the same day, wasn't
it? So it was the same day. Yeah. So I finished and eventually had enough energy to stand up again outside the shop and went and got changed, and then was kind of just wandering through Keswick looking for food, and came across like a big group of runners, and I knew a couple of them, and I was chatting to them, and then they're like, oh yeah, George has just done this really cool, really super fast Bob Graham.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, now I don't feel so cool.
So yeah, George Foster, the second fastest ever Bob Graham, and the now the first fastest British time.
Yeah.
since, in like 30 something years since Billy Bland. Cool.
Yeah.
Do you have a kind of unfinished business in the lakes, would you say, or?
Oh, I'd like to go back and get sub six, definitely. I think with a bit of wrecking, it'd be possible.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, that'll be one of the things that I say I want to do and then probably never find time to do.
But I was just thinking, as I'm saying, do you have unfinished business? Like, how old are you?
28.
28, so yeah, so you're still got, you're still young, so you've still got unfinished business everywhere.
Yeah.
Europe, the lakes, Scotland.
Scotland, Europe, everywhere.
What is, in terms of Scottish races, like not skyrunning, like mm-hmm. What's your kind of favourite or like your ones that stand out from them?
My absolute favourite hill race is the Myatts. From, I think just because I've got really good memories of going there with the team from uni. It was always a really good day out. You'd get the train out at the end of the evening. It's kind of like the beginning of summer where you're just getting those lighter evenings and everything's warming up and you just finished exams. And it's a really good route. You just go straight up, straight down. Yeah, I love it. I think I did it like every year for 7 years or something.
Is it? I've done one Dumiat race, but are a few. Is this the one that there was like really steep and you would like pull yourself up these ropes?
No, not that one.
Do you know which one? I making that up?
I don't know which one that is.
That's Dumiat. Yeah. So, no, this one, where does the one you're talking about start?
So you just start in the, on the university campus.
Okay.
Start at the roundabout that you go in by and run up the roads, and then you kind of really steep track up through the trees. It's a bit really steep, really muddy, really slippery. You have to swing through the trees on your way back down to stay upright. And then you go out, and there's a really deep bog that I got stuck in 1 year actually. And then, yeah, it's just kind of like a really gentle gradient, but really painful to run up to the top, touch the top, and back down again.
That kind of really annoying gradient that's like, it's not steep enough to justify like power hiking.
Yeah.
But you're like, oh, I can run this, it's just really.
You're secretly longing for it to get a bit steeper so you can start walking.
Cool, yeah, I don't think I've done that, but that one.
Yeah, it's one of the Wednesday evening ones that they have in the summer, so it's hard to get to unless you live there. But
good atmosphere.
Just a really good race, yeah. Good atmosphere, really fun.
Brilliant. One thing I wanted to ask before I forget was I noticed, obviously you're an English teacher,
mm-hmm.
But I noticed on your Instagram stories, I think it was, that you have like a separate story for, I presume all the books you're reading.
But yeah, for the books that I've been reading this year.
And like, you're on like, well, you last time I looked, you're on like 40 something.
Yeah, I think I'm on 47 this year.
Like that, I love reading. I feel like I read, I'm not a fast reader, but like a fair amount of books, but I'm like not even half of that in the, so far this year. Like that's a lot of books.
Yeah, it is. I was brought up in a house full of books. My dad owns a bookshop.
Oh, okay.
It's just the kind of thing that I've always grown up doing, and much way before I discovered running, that was like my thing, was reading.
Okay.
I was a regular at the library when I was a kid.
Yeah.
That was my hangout.
Are you sort of always have a book on you then?
Yeah, I've got a bookshelf in my van.
Yeah. I get this sort of a bit of anxiety if I like go away somewhere and I'm like, if I don't have like a spare book, mm-hmm. like what if I run out? Like I do like to.
I hate that feeling where you have to like. You feel like you have to ration the pages left in your book. You're like, I can only read 10 pages now.
So okay, your dad had a bookshop. That's
mm-hmm.
that's cool.
Yeah.
Was that quite, or to not ask you a leading question, how much did that kind of shape, like, growing up and then deciding to, like, did you do English at uni and be an English teacher?
I think a huge amount. I think reading has always been one of the things in the family that we talk about, that we, you know, like, if I go home, one of the first things my dad will ask me, like, so what have you read recently?
Okay.
Some of my earliest, or like, fondest memories of my parents are just really good discussions that we've had around books that we've read and sharing ideas and recommending books to each other. And they would often give me books when I was a teenager and say, I read this book when I was your age now, so I'm going to give it to you.
Okay.
So it was nice reading books, I don't know, when you're angsty and 14 and nothing's, you feel like the world's against you, but it was nice sort of being able to connect with my parents in that way, knowing that they'd read that same book at that same age.
Okay, yeah, yeah. And how, I suppose, thinking about, yeah, being the teenager, and like, how do you feel things are for teenagers now with books?
I think it's harder. I mean, I find it harder to concentrate on things. I mean, even when I am reading, I'll often pick up my phone and get distracted or stuff. I think it's hard to concentrate on anything at the moment. So for teenagers especially, who haven't got that background, they maybe don't have the chance to fall in love with it in the same way. Because maybe I wouldn't read as much if I was growing up now, because there are so many other things to keep you busy and so many things that are designed to lure you in. Even when you don't really want to be scrolling through Instagram or whatever, it's all designed to keep you there. So,
have you seen The Social Dilemma?
Is that the one on Netflix?
Yeah.
Not yet, but a lot of people have said I should watch it.
That's really interesting. So it's about, yeah, social media and how, well, and more than that, how kind of the internet is designed to, yeah, keep you...
Manipulate you.
And yeah, if anyone knows someone who's like, I don't know, a psychologist or anyone who kind of is a runner who also works in that kind of field, like, it'd be really interesting to interview them. You could email me gomatandgoats@gmail.com, because it's obviously, you know, with particularly with the running, particularly with sky running, like, there's the big community and there's so much online.
Mm-hmm.
Of what everyone's up to, but yeah,
it's hard because I love connecting and staying in touch with runners that I've met at races internationally,
yeah,
that, you know, ordinarily without social media you wouldn't be sort of keeping half an eye on what they're up to, chatting to them once a month, finding out how each other are getting on, because you would just fall out of touch. And you are able to do that because of social media, and then you meet up with them more when you are out there, and you build this really nice community. But at the same time, it seems mad that we're wasting time on our phones when we'd all much rather be outside doing something.
It's complicated, isn't it? Yeah, it's complicated. But reading is something special for me anyway about reading, and having that is something that's kind of always there as your own private world,
mm-hmm,
that you can kind of delve into. Actually, I meant to ask you this. I'm just telling you what I think. I was just listening to a podcast actually with Sophie Roberts, who's a writer who has written a book called The Lost Pianos of Siberia, which I've not read yet. But one thing she said, which I thought was interesting, was that through lockdown, she was reading lots of short books, because she thought everyone was finding it, like, we didn't know what was happening, it was all changing quickly, and so your attention span was shorter.
Mm-hmm.
So she was reading a lot of kind of shorter things to keep her attention,
and I thought
that was quite interesting.
I got really into poetry over lockdown, so I've not really read much before. But I think maybe the same kind of thing, like, I picked up a couple of books and, yeah, maybe because they're shorter, I suddenly actually could get into the right mindset to read them in lockdown. And now I've read 4 or 5 collections this year and really enjoyed getting into that.
Okay.
So maybe that's the same kind of thing, reading shorter things because our attention span's all over the place, and, yeah.
Do you tend to have multiple books on the go at once, or do you
normally
know,
just
do
one book?
Time?
One book.
What kind of thing? Sorry, I'm kind of interested in what everyone's reading, so I'm going to stick with this topic for a wee bit longer, if that's okay.
Yeah, it's fine with me.
From looking at your list online, there weren't. There was like a wide, obviously you'd expect because you're an English teacher, but there's like a really wide range of things, and it wasn't, there was classics, there was like modern stuff, there was like what, any kind of particular favourites from this year that stand out?
Favourites from this year, well, I love, this goes back to my dad and books that he would give me to read as a teenager, but I actually really love Westerns.
Okay.
So I've read a couple of those, I've read a Larry McMurtry, and I've read... Oh, I can't remember what the other one was called. But yeah, I love that, like, Wild West, cowboys and...
Okay.
So, yeah.
What was that one called?
Larry McMurtry.
Okay.
The author. It's called The Last Picture Show.
Okay.
Yeah, he's really famous. I actually wrote him a fan letter when I was about 14.
Oh, wow.
So, I'm a big fan.
I need to read some Westerns, yeah. I haven't read many. There's Blood Meridian... You heard of that?
No.
Cormac McCarthy.
No.
That's quite a dark one about sort of cowboys and Indians times.
Mm.
And what's your favourite book to teach?
Favourite book to teach? Favourite book to teach? I've been teaching a lot of... I taught a Roddy Doyle book called Greyhound of a Girl. To some second years a couple of years back, and that was really good.
Okay.
That was all about kind of intergenerational relationships and death, and well, it sounds a bit depressing, but it's really good. And it's set in Ireland, and it's this daughter and her mother, and the grandmother is dying, and the great grandmother comes back as a ghost, and they go on like a road trip to the farm where they all grew up and revisit their roots and sort of explore the family background and what's shaped the generations and things like that.
Okay.
And it's really interesting.
That sounds good.
Yeah.
And that story that's called?
Greyhound of a Girl.
Okay. Cool. And maybe just, one more on the books. What is your favourite kind of outdoor or like adventure kind of book?
The Living Mountain, Nan Shepherd's.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It's a classic, but it's a classic for a reason. It's really good. I suppose it's not really outdoorsy rather than adventure-y. Writing about the Cairngorms, and writing about the seasons, and it's weird because normally I love fiction and I love a plot and I like following a storyline, but this is more just her writing about the things that she comes across out in the mountains and describing changes that she sees and how she interacts with the landscape, but it's incredibly well written, really detailed prose that's fascinating to read.
Yeah, it's just a beautiful description of some amazing, like a real being at one with the Cairngorms and just loving the Cairngorms.
Hiya.
Yeah.
Hiya, Finlay. Sorry, I'm just dropping
something off. Oh, yeah. Hello. Oh, yeah, we just had a wee pause there because I had a delivery of something dropped off. From one of our friends who thankfully didn't fall down the steps in the dark. So that's good. Where were we?
Talking about
Nan Shepherd.
Yeah. And she puts a lot of... she writes a lot of things, I think, that... She put a lot of things into words that I wasn't conscious of until I read it. And then she talks about... I mean, there's one bit where she talks about how looking into a loch, the water actually makes everything seem clearer than actually when you're looking just through air. And I was like, oh, I've noticed that, but I've never sort of formulated that thought before. And then her putting it into words makes me appreciate it more now.
That's lovely. Yeah, I need to reread that. Right, I think it'd be good to move on and talk about the Glencoe skyline.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked quite a lot on the podcast actually about Glencoe, and actually the girl who just dropped off, the lady who just dropped off a rucksack was just running in Glencoe as well.
Oh, nice.
With Girls on Hills. So, yeah, we make no apologies for talking about Lochaber, and Glencoe is, yeah, a real special place. I thought it'd be really good to actually spend some time specifically talking about the Skyline route, because it's, you know, it's a relatively new race. It's mm-hmm. part of the, you know, obviously it's a sky race. I think, yeah, it was the first UK sky race, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
Shane O'Leary's race, possibly the first one, was 2015.
Yeah.
And you've done the Ring of Steel, which is the sort of sister race.
Yeah.
that's a bit smaller.
I've done the
Ring
of Steel, and I've done the VK.
And the VK, so you've, when did you start doing those races?
In 2016, I did the first Ring of Steel and the first VK.
Okay.
And then went back the next year and did the Ring of Steel, then went back the next year and did them both again, and then last year finally worked my way up to the Skyline.
Yeah, so first time on the Skyline.
Yep.
And first place.
Yeah, yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you. It was a good day. It was a very good day. It's a really nice route as well. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's about 55 kilometres, isn't it?
Yeah, something like that.
And is it just under 5,000 metres of ascent?
4,746 metres.
We've got the map in front of us, so yeah, it says there. Yeah, so it's a good old way and a lot of up and down.
It's a lot of up and down, and yeah, I think my legs were very, very tired at the end of that. I staggered across the finish line there as well. But.
So maybe, yeah, what was it like? So that year, so last year, did you do the VK that year?
No.
So had you had quite a rest before it, or?
No, so Zakup, the race that we were talking about earlier.
Oh yeah.
Was the weekend before.
Well, really?
Yeah.
Okay. So how far is that?
That was maybe 25-ish.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah. And then I think just on an impulse, I was like, oh, I've got nothing on. Might as well give the Skyline a go, see what happens. Yeah, I think I seem to have my best races when I haven't been planning on doing it, and then just go in, and I haven't stressed about it, and do it on a whim, go out aiming to have fun, and that's when I seem to perform well.
It's really interesting, that.
Yeah.
Why do you think, what changes when you're, when it's like that?
And there's no pressure. There's no, oh, I want to do this. I've spent hours analysing the route. I know where I'm going to push, and I'm going to know where I should be at this time. And no, you don't have any targets necessarily. And for some people, that would be a nightmare. But I think for me, I go out and I just really want to enjoy the day.
Okay.
And that puts me in a good place to push hard, because I enjoy pushing hard.
Yeah.
When I'm enjoying the whole, you don't get into the same, well, I still get into lows, but not the same lows, because you haven't got the pressure to do well. So if you're not, things aren't going to plan, you just think, well, I'll just ease off and have fun, because that's the main aim. And then you recover from the low quicker, and then you feel good.
and two things you said there I think are really interesting. Like, one is like, yeah, like to remember, like, it's, why do we run? Why do we go in the mountains? Like, it's to enjoy it, and
yeah,
it's because we enjoy it. It's to have fun. So if you can bring that feeling into racing, that's you're starting on a good footing. And then, yeah, the other thing is, I can't remember actually. What was the other thing you said? Having fun, and like, you enjoy pushing, and like, that's kind of, for some people they might find that quite hard to, I find that hard to explain, but what do you mean by that feeling?
It is hard to explain. I think, well, a lot of runners are divided between whether they prefer the uphill or the downhill. And a lot of people say they love, like, the fun of running downhill, but I like the pain of running uphill. I guess it's just finding your limits, pushing your body as hard as you can, seeing what you can get out of it, and in some weird way enjoying that feeling.
Yeah, and it's really, I think it's it varies quite a bit person to person. Like, George Foster was talking with Billy Bland to Paul Corney on the Kong Running podcast about the Bob Graham. And Billy Bland was talking about how, you know, people talk about like lead legs or dead legs or at the end of a race, like screaming legs. And, and he was saying, well, I never, if I remember it rightly, he was saying, yeah, I never really felt that. Like, and I think, yeah, some people, people's individual response to pushing hard, I think, is quite different as how they feel. Like, yeah, I'd say when I'm pushing hard, like I feel it. Like, it's not like I'm not trying or it's not like I'm not trying, but I'm not sort of hurting, I would say. Like, I'm not, people talk about being deep in the pain cave. Like, I don't really feel like that. Like, it's not an agony.
No. And I think, well, so, I think it depends on the day as well. So sometimes I'll be pushing hard in a race, and if I'm not in the right headspace or something else isn't clicked into place, then I'm running along thinking, oh, this is awful, and when's it going to be over, and I don't want to be here, and all of that. And actually I can be at that exact same level of pain or that same level of effort on a good day, and it will feel easy.
Yeah,
just
okay.
Because your perspective's different, maybe you're having more fun, or something's changed, and actually you're not necessarily working any harder on the bad days. It's just that the way it feels is different.
Yeah, and maybe that's why, like you said, some of your best performances are where you're kind of doing it on like last minute decision. You aren't putting pressure on, and you're able to kind of keep that enjoyment of it.
Keep the enjoyment. Also, I think I get a weird kind of satisfaction from being uncomfortable and overcoming that discomfort. So carrying on through it, managing it, and making sure you get to the finish line as quickly as possible, but without destroying yourself.
Yeah.
So that's quite satisfying when you get that, when you get that balance right.
And so this this last year's Glencoe Skyline, it was, it sounds like you were saying it was one of these days where things were, you were enjoying it, and and things, it was flowing.
I'd say I was enjoying it up until there. Where, however you say that.
So you've all the way around the kind of south side of Glencoe, and then you've done the Anakigak.
Yeah.
And after the technical difficulties there, you're back on the kind of more runnable bit.
More runnable bit, but still quite tussocky and uneven, and it goes on for a long time. And then you think about that little sort of flat bit down the West Highland Way to Kinlochleven, and you just want it to be over at that point. The fun bit's all done, and you're like, oh no, I'm done now.
So what was the start like? What was the atmosphere like at the start?
Start was really good. It's quite an early start, but there's a big crowd, and all the races that weekend have got quite a lot of hype around them. They've got, you know, music playing. I think they've all got bagpipes at the start, so you're feeling pretty pumped up and ready to go. Started out, sort of fell into a group of a few other guys. Andrew Barrington was there, so I ended up chatting to him for the first few kilometres. Probably went a bit faster than I should have, but it's nice to have a chat. Saw a really nice sunrise coming over into Glencoe, through, it's like one of those orange hazy ones where you get like the peaks of the mountains through the clouds.
Okay.
So that was pretty special. Yeah, and then that was the start, descended down to the roads.
I think it's quite, I've done it once in 2016, I'd love to do it again. I think it's quite easy to go too fast or fast at the start, because obviously you're on a big wide track for quite a long way.
It's very runnable.
And like you said, there's the bagpipes, it's got the kind of the whole sky running sort of atmosphere with the, I think it has psych music as well, doesn't
it?
Yeah,
they have one of those really dramatic countdowns to the start, maybe? I can't remember.
Have you done Zagama yet?
No, I really want to do Zagama.
Yeah. That, for me, is like was the height of like the most intense like race, sky race for the like the for a lot of reasons, but like at the start, like it's like ramping up from like 10 minutes before, and then like it keeps going up a notch and going up a notch, and like the like Chariots of Fire kind of epic music, and then like 2 minutes to go and you think it couldn't get any more epic, and then it like ramps up again, and then yeah, unsurprisingly, everyone goes out absolutely like caning it so fast. So there's definitely a potential for that, and you got this, it sounds like, yeah, great weather, or well, a great sunrise.
Great sunrise, then the weather definitely came in.
Okay, so at this point, what, there was cloud, but it was dry at this point, was it?
It was dry at this point, and then you cross the roads and you go up Curve Ridge, and that was all in the clouds.
Ah.
So remember, I think just where you start scrambling, you basically just went into, you know, you can see a wall of cloud, and you go in and you just can't see anything anymore.
And had you been out there before, or how much did you know Glencoe before this race?
Hardly any of it. I hadn't been up Curve Ridge before. I hadn't done the Anhiga before.
Okay.
I'd just been out supporting, in the years before, like the previous few years, I'd gone out up Bidyan Nambain. I'd run up there the previous couple of years, so I knew that little stretch from the road up and down pretty well, but I didn't know the rest of it.
That must have been, yeah, really cool, sort of going up onto Bukletta is more, up by this classic scramble curved ridge.
Yeah.
In a race, but having not done it before, like how did that feel?
Yeah, it was really good. I loved it. You just feels amazing to be climbing up something like that, whether you're in a race or not, and exploring new mountains. And I think the clouds added to the atmosphere as well. You feel pretty extreme when you're doing something like that, and with no visibility. It probably helped as well because I couldn't look down.
Was it dry, or was it a bit damp on the rock?
It wasn't raining, but it was a bit damp.
Okay.
Yeah.
But at this point, you'd already done like the Ring of Steel a ton of times, and or several times, and the
Tromso. Tromso twice.
Yeah, Tromso. A brief aside to Tromso, because it's quite Scottish. Well, in some ways, it's quite Scottish up there, like Scotland on steroids, maybe.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, you've got the same, you've got bits of bog, you've got boulder fields, you've got scrambling up a ridge, you've got not very much running on a path, so it feels quite Scottish.
And how... I maybe know the answer to this, because we went for that run over Carmarthenshire and things, but like how do you find the sort of more technical scrambling stuff? How do you like it?
I really like it. I like I don't really know why I like it so much, but I really like it. I think I do relatively all right in it. I guess I like the challenge of it and the excitement of it.
And you talked quite a bit with the guy Seb and Simcoe, about how you weren't really exposed to kind of stuff like that, like when you were younger, and yeah, how do you think you've just got into it through living here and enjoying the mountains? Like how would you say that's a strength now, or what's been the progression?
I think it's a strength. I think when I started hill running and I was all right at it, but I always did better at the ones, you know, the steeper ones. I was definitely better at hill running than I was at cross country or road running.
Okay.
And going back to what we were saying earlier, I think part of that goes to the fact that I enjoy it more.
Yeah.
I just love it. I just love being out in the mountains. I love exploring places. I love going up technical grounds and descending it less. I like going up it.
So this is maybe all feeding into why you had such a great race. Like you said, well, I didn't feel pressured because I didn't know I was going to do it.
And mm-hmm.
So I'm just out for a fun day and I'm enjoying it, and I've got some scrambling in a new place with loads of technical terrain.
And it's always been an area that I'd wanted to explore for years and years. So we used to drive up through it a lot, and I'd always look out the window and be like, I want to go there. But like we were saying, you have these places you want to go and you never get around to it. So I just thought this would be good. Do it all at once. Why not?
Yeah. And of course, this is a marked race. So so the fact that you hadn't been there didn't... Or how much do you think it sort of... did it affect you at all? Or was the marking pretty good? And
the marking's pretty good. I think, you know, if you don't know a route, you always could do it faster if you do know the route, but I didn't make any massive navigational errors or anything just because the marking's so good. There's a flag every 3 meters or something. So
it's a bit harder to pace because you haven't sort of been over the ground, but there was no major kind of navigational issues or anything.
Like I was saying, I definitely underestimated that long Tasky descent from the Anarchy back to the West Highland Way. I was not expecting that. But these are things you learn.
And because I suppose like mentally, once you've kind of done all the stuff on the south side, Bidian, come down to the road, done that massive climb back to the Anarchy, and done the Anarchy, you sort of then thinking, oh, that, you know, you've been kind of focusing on, oh, once I get the Anahigak done,
yeah,
it'll be okay, it'll be almost done. But no, there's still, 10K is a quick look there.
Yeah. So mentally I was at the finish line, but physically I was a very long way from the finish line.
What was it? Was it all in the clag on the Buckle then?
Yeah, so that was all in the clag, and I got quite frustrated around there because I felt like I had lost a lot of places because I was just descending really badly and couldn't really see where I was going very well. I'm not the best descender anyway, and you know, sometimes you just don't get into a good rhythm, and once you've not done that, it's hard to get into it. So yeah, I lost a bit of time, but then maybe that paid off because I went a bit slower and was less tired later on, so who knows.
Yeah And it's I was down that descent off the Buckle the other day, actually with Andy Barrington, who you mentioned, who was leading that race last year for a
lot
of time.
Yeah, he led a lot of it.
Where was he in the end? Fourth, maybe?
Third? I don't know.
Sorry, Andy, can't remember where you were, but he had a great run. But just on a training run, I was out with him and we were going down there, and it's really rough. I'd kind of forgotten, because in a race you're so focused, but I'd forgotten how rough. There's a wee slabby bit as well.
Yeah. And when it's that slightly wet, everything's a bit slippery and it's early in the race and you don't want to push too hard. Yeah, I definitely struggled with that bit.
But you probably stood yourself in good stead by like easing off a bit, because like you say, it's still relatively early in the race.
Yeah. We've still got a long way to go.
You don't want to injure yourself at that point.
Yeah.
Where were you related to like the other women? Were you kind of in a pack, or were you leading at this point? Or?
I didn't see any of the other women.
Okay.
I started off, I think, right from the very start, I was at the front. There was a group of maybe five of us, but it was just me and four men. At one point, I was ambitiously leading the whole race.
Oh, really?
That was definitely a mistake.
Where was that?
Ran on the West Highland Way.
Okay.
Yeah. I've got some of the things where you're just running along chatting, and like, I'm not supposed to be here.
Well, if you were chatting, you obviously,
yeah.
Do you think starting off quite fast, do you think that just ended up working out fine, or do you think that was an issue, like, in the second half of the race?
I think it worked out fine. I think it did... I got tired in the second half of the race after the road crossing.
Okay.
But I think that was more due to the fact that I forgot to keep eating and drinking.
Okay.
I'd been quite good at taking gels on until that point. And then I think you cross the road and you see your friends and there's a big crowd and you get excited and then you attack the next uphill. I think I saw you there as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And then suddenly you're like, oh, I haven't taken any food on for an hour. And then you feel tired, you're trying to play catch up, but when you're 8 hours into a race, playing catch up doesn't really work.
Yeah, I think, it's difficult. It's good to start getting the food in a lot just early on.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's probably also when you're going to be able to eat as much.
Yeah.
What were you tending to eat?
I just had gels for that.
Okay.
I'm not very good at eating whilst running. I'm not very good at chewing and running at the same time. So gels work out pretty well for me. That's just what I use in all the races, actually.
Okay.
Yeah. And some electrolyte mix.
Did you have enough gels and stuff, or was there any issues with that?
No, I think I had enough. I just forgot to eat them.
Going up that big climb.
Okay. I think because you refuel at the road crossing, and then you think, okay, I don't need to refuel again for a while.
Okay, yeah.
But actually, it's a long climb, and you do need to take stuff on. And then you're doing the Anahigak, and you're using your hands, and it's not really the ideal place to take stuff on. So, yeah, and then you've broken the rhythm of eating, and it's, yeah.
It's a brutal climb. I mean, you've already run like half the route. You know, and it's so steep.
So steep.
And
yeah.
Just like, and it's like, is it 900 meters? Yeah, it's like 900 of vert.
And you feel, you got a little boost from the crowd at the bottom, so you start off quite strong, and then, well, I started off quite strong and then realised I'd started too strong.
Soon the crowd are a tiny
blip
below
you. Soon the crowd disappeared and you're by yourself. Halfway up a hill, like, oh no.
And I think, like, in that race, because it's so long, it's quite easy to be on your own for hours, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
Were you... So, jumping back a wee bit to sort of between the Buchholz and kind of at that place, were you on your own at that point, or were you still with... So you hadn't seen it, you were leading and you didn't see any of the women, but were you... kind of around some other guys, or...?
There were guys sort of moving around me, like they'd overtake me on their descents, and then I'd catch up with them on the climbs.
Okay.
So I wasn't by myself, but I wasn't running in a group either. It was sort of a lot of backwards and forwards.
Okay.
Which I quite like, actually. It's quite nice.
Yeah.
You normally get a bit of chat when you've seen someone three times already, and you take the piss out of each other a bit, and...
And how were you on that, what feels like a long way up the, was it the Larrig Eild? So after the wee buckle where you go over the col,
mm-hmm.
and then you're going up the track before you kind of go up onto the kind of massif of Gideon again.
So that's where I started to feel good again, after the bit of the wobble I had descending. I like the long climbs.
Okay.
So
that's a runnable, gradual, long climb.
But it was working. I was catching people up. I saw a friend who gave me a big cheer, and like I was saying, that always makes a huge difference. Then everything clicked back into place. And it's funny, because when you're feeling rubbish, it doesn't feel like you're ever going to get back on track. But then suddenly, sometimes you're like, oh, I feel good again. And you can go... And that kind of happened there. And then, yeah, it was good.
And then after that, were you up in the cloud again?
Up in the clouds, it was raining, it was pretty cold.
All right, okay.
The out and back was very slippery. But yeah, it was all good fun.
Yeah, I was on that going the other way in my round recently, and it wasn't raining or anything, but it was in the cloud just in the start of the day, and even that was enough. It had been raining the day before.
Mm.
It was enough to be like, oh yeah, this feels a wee bit slippy on these rocks.
Yeah.
So it does make quite a difference.
It does make a difference, and I think most people put their jackets on because it got pretty cold.
And then, I suppose, then you're down. Anything particular of note coming down off Bidian? Down valley.
That was the bit that I knew pretty well, just from running up and down it the previous years, supporting other people. So that was good, because I finally was on familiar territory, and you know there's people waiting at the bottom for you. So I really enjoyed that descent, actually. For someone who doesn't enjoy descending, that was a good one.
Yeah, it's that kind of cobbled kind of path. It's quite cool.
Yeah. and it's quite an unusual surface to run on in Scotland. But it's good fun. It's good to... I think what's really nice about that route is that you cover a lot of different terrains. So you've got scrambling bits, you've got tussocky bits, you've got cobbled paths like that, you've got running on tracks. So yeah, it's just nice to do a mixture of things.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of got everything. Yeah,
yeah, it's got a bit of everything. No roads. It's good.
And we talked about the going up onto the Anakigak, that long climb. Mm-hmm. Like, what was the Anakigak like? Because again, you'd not been there, so you're getting to experience it kind of in the bubble of a race that you're running. So that must have felt pretty good.
That was really good. I had my shoelace snapped.
Oh no!
Halfway along it, I think. I remember, like, being like, oh god, I feel really wobbly, I don't know why. And I looked down, one of my shoelaces just snapped, and my shoe was, like, not done up at all. So I did some makeshift knots and fixed it. But it was good. It was, yeah, it's the kind of terrain that I really enjoy moving over. And it was quite nice, I think, not having done it before, because every time I came around a corner or looked onto the next section, it was just, like, something fresh and... Yeah, I didn't really know where I was, so I was just focusing on what was immediately in front of me all the time.
Okay.
Rather than thinking, like, okay, once I've done this bit, it's that bit. Or thinking, when's it, like, how far until the end? I had no idea where the end was. So I was just literally tackling it rock by rock.
Okay. So it sounds like that was, at that point, maybe that was quite good that you didn't know where it went.
I think so, yeah.
But... how does that contrast with, like, later on, I think you were saying, like, the bit after the Anakigak seemed to go on forever.
Yeah, that bit seemed to go on for a long time. But I think that's because you didn't have the challenge and the excitement anymore.
Okay, yeah.
So it wasn't, you know, doing it little section by little section and to get this feeling of accomplishment every time you complete a little section.
Yeah.
It was, I can see a long grassy descent and I don't want to run any of that, but I've got to.
You know, the kind of technical, the kind of full concentration, well, not, the stuff that you, is technical, so you're thinking more about your foot placements and your hands.
Mm-hmm. You're totally absorbed in what you're doing.
Maybe that means you're thinking less, well, not maybe, it does mean you're thinking less about how hard it is and how tough you're working. You didn't have that side of it.
Yeah.
But you still had the fatigue and you still had to keep running.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. There was also a bit along there where I was quite tired and just got to some rocks and had to climb up them and just couldn't work out how to do it. Like, it wasn't particularly difficult, but I think because I hadn't been there before and was tired and just had a bit of a blank. I remember I stood there looking at them and then these three guys caught up with me and I was like, okay, I'll watch them go and I'll just do what they do because I can't make my brain work. And they nipped up it in no time and I tried to follow them and just realised they had much longer arms and legs than I do. And I couldn't reach any of the holes that they got to. So I had to start again.
Were you cold at this point? You'd warmed up or...?
No, it wasn't too cold.
No.
It was quite nice. I think it was... still quite cloudy. It was the kind of where the cloud blows in and out so you can see for a bit,
okay.
And then the cloud comes in, you can't see. But it wasn't cold and it wasn't raining.
Good.
Yeah.
And then I think I remember you read it, you a write up, or are you talking about this kind of the final West Ham Way track back to Kinloch Leven, which on the way out you go out so confident and so fast.
Yeah.
And what was that like at the end, going back?
That felt like a slog. It's kind of a continuation of that long grassy descent. I'd picked up a bit of a niggle in my hip as well, and I think by that point, you know you're so close to winning, but you also have no idea who's behind you, where they are, how they're feeling. I did a lot of looking over my shoulder.
Okay.
And then as soon as you start to get a bit closer to town and there's people and they're cheering you on, you kind of forget all that and just enjoy the rest of the descent and the run into the finish line.
It's great that if you could, like, bottle that feeling of, like, when you're, like, just coming up to the end and you kind of know it's in the bag.
Yeah.
And you kind of... you kind of forget feeling like you're trying really hard, and you know, you're like, yes,
yeah,
that kind of euphoria of, oh, it's working out.
Yeah.
If you could bottle that and like have a wee gel of it like halfway through, that'd be quite good.
That'd be amazing. You suddenly feel that all the pain would go away.
So yeah, and how close was second?
I think she was way behind.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly.
Okay. So you didn't see her when you were looking over your shoulder?
No, I imagined her, but I never actually saw her.
Sometimes, like when I was earlier on, when I was quite weak on like the actual running sections, like
mm-hmm.
earlier in my running path, and yeah, so any like road sections and things I remember early on like Rob Jeb often and other people, but particularly I remember Rob like coming and like beating me on road sections and things. So quite often I would use that, and I would like imagine like a ghost Rob Jeb like chasing me down,
yeah,
to kind of spur myself on to to keep running. Yeah. So you finished, you won.
Yeah.
Were you pleased with your time?
Really pleased, yeah. Yeah, I was just really happy with it and thought I'd done well, and I'd really like to go back and do it again. But yeah, another year.
Yeah. Yeah, so obviously, yeah, none of those races, well, no races really happened this
no,
year.
No. It was meant to be the Om this weekend. But...
Yeah, so we were sitting outside in my makeshift studio. We still have to call it the studio.
Studio, yeah.
The wind is blustering around. It's like, yeah, last night, Saturday night in a wee tent would have been quite grim, I think.
I think it would have been typical Om.
Yeah. Have you done the Om?
Just the once.
Okay.
And I swore I'd never do it again. And then signed up this year and was secretly quite relieved when it got cancelled.
Yeah. Yeah, it was kind of mixed emotions. I was meant to be doing it as well.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, it's a shame, but oh well.
I'll survive.
I'll sleep in a bed instead of damp in a tiny tent.
Yeah. I'll be warm.
So I guess, yeah, that's great to talk about Glencoe Skyline and go through the route. I think it's a great route. Yeah, I'd love to do it again. Sounds like we haven't seen the last of Georgia Tindley on
unfinished
on that
business
route.
Everywhere.
One thing we were talking about before the interview was, and you mentioned your camper van.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to talk to you maybe a wee bit about camper vanning and Scotland and something that you'd obviously noticed because I read about it on your blog.
Mm-hmm.
Was kind of the double-edged sword, shall we say, of, I suppose it's tourism in general in Scotland and probably everywhere, but you've got a family connection to Scotland, particularly through, is it Lewis? Is it
Lewis? Yeah.
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 So you've spent quite a lot of time there at a family.
Yeah, kind of... got there every summer and a few other times a year when I was a kid, and just got there more and more now that I live closer and can nip up for a few days at a time.
And how have you seen things change in terms of like busyness and tourism over the last? Well, since you've known it.
The last 28 years.
Yeah.
It's definitely getting busier. The sort of like a little, the village that we have a house in is a very, very popular campsite and, wild camping site. And I think maybe 15 years ago, we started to notice it getting busier. And it's just got busier and busier, and it's changing the landscape. And the beach has changed a lot as a result of it, because the dunes have all eroded, and there's quite a lot of damage done to the Macha as well. And it started off, you know, there'd be maybe one or two tents, and now most of the time you walk down to the beach and there's, I think this summer there was 15 tents and a few vans as well. And it's definitely got to the point now where there's only 7 or 8 houses in the village, so
okay,
it can feel a bit strange when you go down to the beach and you're outnumbered by the tourists, and I think that causes some tension in the area.
Yeah, and I have real good memories of growing up like the far northwest, you know, in vans or, you know, usually kind of off season, but certainly this year I was up there actually for a wee bit, and it's the first time I've been up there since it's the North Coast 500 route.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, there's loads of factors, I mean, isn't there? I mean, COVID has meant people weren't going abroad, so that would definitely make this year's busier.
Yeah.
But it was just so busy, on particularly way up towards Durness, like it's single track roads, so there's just this constant stream of traffic, and you know, every passing place you're kind of jiggling to get people past each other, and I was just, I mean, we were up there too, like we were part of the traffic. I'm not saying I'm any different, but you're just very conscious of, yeah, these small communities, like they've come to rely on tourism for a lot of the income, but also like you just know that the infrastructure there hasn't really been, you know, the money hasn't been put into the infrastructure to kind of support increased numbers.
Mm-hmm.
and especially, you know, someone could, they could hire a big, huge camper van in Inverness and stock up there with food and go round and kind of, you know, car park camp for a week potentially.
And then they're not supporting the businesses and the communities that do rely on tourism as well. They're just sort of passing through and not contributing in that way, which is problematic because then they bring the busyness and the litter and the sort of sense of someone else coming into your area but without bringing any of the positives.
And yeah, and litter takes many forms, not least the human waste kind of factor, which, yeah, I mean, that's a real serious issue.
And did you see that they've put out trowels in all the passing places up there?
I did see that.
Everyone who turns up.
Gearlock Way, Angelic Way, yeah.
Yeah.
So this was, I can't remember the exact wording, but it was like Highland Toilet Network or something, and it was a trowel, and it was saying basically, it had some info on, look, if you need to go outside, like this is the responsible way to do it, like
mm-hmm.
go far enough away, you know, dig a deep hole, bury everything, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I would guess that the locals have just decided we have to do something because no one else is doing anything.
Yeah.
and this is our place and we need to protect it.
Yeah, I think that's the problem, is that COVID has changed the way that we live and it's changed the way that tourism operates, and I think that's all changed, but the infrastructure's playing catch up.
Yes.
And
yes.
It's not there yet, and that's causing problems. And you know, you talk to locals, and some locals are very pro-tourism and pro-people coming to the community, and they've got businesses that rely on it, and then you talk to others that actually get no benefit from it, and they're a fragile, elderly community in quite a remote part of Scotland, and they're worried about the litter and the damage, but they're also worried about bringing COVID into the area.
Yes.
Which is an added risk for this year.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, actually, this was quite near Fort William. This was in Le Cabre that this happened to you, I think. What, you had quite a good story about an incident, a confrontation is the word I was looking
confrontation.
For when you were vanning.
It was just up the road from here, and it was, I'd spent for 3 or 4 weeks driving around in the van, had a great time, had no issues, and it was the last night of my trip before I went back across to Canusi, and went to bed, was all settled down, was parked up at the side of a quiet road, but not in anyone's way, not in a passing place, and then about midnight, flashing lights, lots of beeping, shouting, got out, this man had pulled up in the car next to me, and just started having a go at me, telling me that I couldn't be there, telling me that it was illegal, that he was going to call the police, I had to move on, and then his ultimate final threat was that he was going to poo on my van. Yeah, which was not the most pleasant thought, and also a logistical challenge, I think.
It would be a logistical challenge for him.
Yeah. Part of me was tempted to be like, so, okay, how?
I mean, that's really aggressive.
It was aggressive.
To approach a van that's just parked up quietly, you know, some of the curtains drawn.
Yeah, doing gone your to bed for the night, like lights were off. No, nothing outside of the van. Hadn't lit a fire or done anything. Just literally just parked up. Yeah, could have been a parked car, essentially. And it is aggressive and it is off-putting, I think, as well.
And that could have, you know, that could have really backfired for him, because it could have been, you know, a bunch of, you know, I was going to say hard men, I don't know what the PC way is, but, you know, that could have been dangerous for him.
Yeah.
But equally, like, that's really, you know, you might have felt really vulnerable being on your own,
mm-hmm.
and someone suddenly comes up.
Yeah, like some man comes up and knocking on your windows and shouting. It's not a particularly nice feeling.
And yeah, clearly that's, you know, I don't condone that, but to maybe give, to try and think about his attitude and his reasoning for a second, like, you would assume maybe he's had a bad experience with people camping,
yeah,
in the past.
And that's it, I think, as someone who's travelling around in a van, you see people who do it well and do it responsibly, and you see people who don't, and you know that for a lot of people, they're lumping you together with the people who are not doing it responsibly, leaving litter, lighting fires, damaging the environment. And I think that's why the way forward isn't to discourage people from travelling, but more to educate people about the right way to do it, which is why things like the trowels are a great initiative. It's unfortunate that it's necessary, but actually there are people travelling around who maybe wouldn't normally holiday in the UK who don't know how to responsibly go for a wild poo. So putting those resources there is really important, and better than trying to scare them off, I think.
And I think that's the kind of situation, you know, for right or wrong, like things like the NC500, like it's being advertised, it's out there as a thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
People are gonna come up to go and do it, and they aren't gonna know, like, that there aren't toilets, you know, or there are some toilets, and this, you know, some communities are doing amazing jobs to keep toilets open.
Yeah.
But like, everyone's got to go to the toilet most days, like, and everyone needs to eat, you know, and find somewhere to sleep. Like,
yeah.
There is, so. It's, I'm always going on about the need for having some kind of better system for, you know, for the basics like toilets, because,
mm-hmm.
You know, traveling elsewhere, you know, I've traveled like in America and like New Zealand, and they've, mm-hmm. both got, like, yeah, they're different countries, and I'm not saying that these solutions would work in our wet, busy, small island, but like they have got solutions to basically fairly basic toilets in different areas, so that they're not fancy, but there's somewhere to go when you've got to go, because you've got to go.
It happens. So,
it happens all the time. It's, yeah, and it's not going to stop happening. So, like, it's a predictable need.
Yeah.
So, yeah, ideally we're going to get infrastructure investment in that.
Mm-hmm.
Councils are struggling for money, but ideally some investment into that. I mean, you know, I'm sure things like tourist tax have been talked about.
Yeah.
But in the short term, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Like, trying to educate people about, you know, how do you go vanning
mm-hmm.
responsibly.
And how do you make it a positive experience for everyone, not just you, or, you know, if you're interacting with people, and, yeah, I don't know, just respecting where you are. And
what kind of things would be, like, I mean, again, we're not experts on this, we're just interested in it. I thought it'd be interesting to talk about, because we like going to remote places, which often necessitates, you know, being in a van or camping, or, you know, or indeed going outdoors, with your trowel or whatever it is. So what kind of things do you think would be the kind of key few points just to finish on of how we could kind of be responsible?
I think it's about being responsible with your litter and your waste. I think it's about respecting the environment, so not damaging in any way, not, you know, cutting down trees like fire, not just moving things around, taking things away with you. Like if you see a pretty rock and take it away, great, but if 500 people do that summer,
yeah,
then suddenly there's no rocks left. I also think it's about supporting the local businesses. So if you can afford to rent a van or buy a van and take time off work and go travel around, you can afford to go to a cafe and support that business. You can afford to not do a big Tesco shop in Inverness, but to go out and buy from the smaller shops that the local communities need to be there because they keep them in stock, and you can help that by buying from them and keeping them in business.
I've definitely been guilty of, I think probably everyone has, of like taking your supplies and going somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And it's even a bit harder with COVID, and that there's a bit more rules about going in places. But I think you're right. Like now I try and go somewhere, and you know, whether it's food shopping from the small shop or go into a cafe. Mm-hmm. And
or even if you're, you know, because it is the Highlands and it is COVID, so sometimes you're not sure what's going to be open.
Yeah.
But if you take foods and you have the food with you to eat if you need it, but then actually you can buy extra supplies if the shop is open, if the cafe is there. And also it's a good excuse to eat some nice food.
Well, you're saving your money because you're not
the amount of times I've used supporting a local business as an excuse to have a really nice meal this summer is a
brilliant.
Yeah,
and people, I think you're right though, there's quite a lot of just people don't know, you know, like people think, oh, I'm going camping. Oh, you have a fire when you go camping.
Yeah.
And you know, so that they're sort of twisting this like live branch off a tree, and like, of course, like anyone who knows is like, well, that live wood doesn't burn. Like, you don't do that. So yeah, education and getting the message out there.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's really interesting, and hopefully, there are a lot of people thinking this kind of thing, and be interesting to see how we see the situation develop over the next few years as more people are, you know, thinking, well, how do we change this for the better and make this more responsible and more sustainable.
Mm-hmm. I think it's really important that we don't discourage people from travelling up here as well and getting out and exploring it, because one of my favourite things about Scotland is the right to roam and the fact that you can go out, and the more people that access that, the more people that get the physical and mental health benefits of being outside and enjoying the landscape, the better. So it's not about stopping people from coming, it's just ensuring that it's done in the right way.
Yeah, right to roam is really powerful. Like I was running in Ireland at the start of this year, and they're saying we don't have that, and obviously England don't have that either. We don't have that, and a lot of the mountains are like farmers own the land, and it's really quite hard to get permission or to put races on. So we really need to keep hold of that, I suppose educating people and bringing up the level, the average level of kind of responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great. Anything else you wanted to mention? Any other burning things?
Can't think of anything.
No.
No.
Well, hey, thanks. It's been a whistle stop through loads of different things, and it looks like you're only just getting started with with skyrunning, so hopefully you can get some of that next year. And with FKTs, good to see your enthusiasm for that.
Yeah, have to get out and give some more a go.
We didn't even talk about skiing, so that might be for the future.
Oh, yeah, and the snow's just come.
Yeah. The Schemo Scotland races, they're not going to have races this year. They're going to have like time trials.
Mm-hmm.
And there's going to be a team's time trial on the classic Cairngorm 4000ers route.
Yeah.
So that will all be on schemoscotland.com. It's easy to find on if you Google it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, just to mention it to you and other listeners as well.
Yeah.
Thanks very much, Georgia.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's been great.
So that's us. If you have got tinnitus, I'm sorry. I don't know quite what's happening with the mics, but I might use the backup recording, and I'll try and get it sorted for next time. But thanks very much. We're Go Mountain Goats, and see you next time.